I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
In place of democracy, very good.
Welcome to this week's Democracy Sausage episode from the Australian National University in Canberra. I'm Mark Kenny from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute, and we put this program out each week with the assistance of the Crawford School of Public Policy's policyforum.net and specifically EP Angus Blackman, who doesn't get shouted out enough. So here's a sobering thought. More Australians are currently experiencing restrictions on their movement than at any time in this country's history, including World War II. Self-styled freedom warrior New South Wales Liberal Premier Gladys Berejiklian has been backtracking at a rate of knots in recent weeks, forced into a humiliating series of ever tighter lockdown rules, in some cases harder than those in Victoria last year, which, let's be clear, Berejiklian and her party depicted as unacceptable and unnecessary. "That's not the way New South Wales does things," she skited, courting the approval of PM Scott Morrison. There was a degree of dog whistling in this, of course, because Morrison's gushing praise of New South Wales always carried just that little bit of anti-Victorian, anti-Dan Andrews sentiment. Doubtless last year's deadly Victorian outbreak came from unconscionable failures in government management in Victoria. But as I've said on this podcast before, the hard-nosed response to rid the state of any community transmission was probably the single most effective lever of public policy I've ever seen pulled. Now, New South Wales is dealing with its own outbreak, and a bleak Australian winter is delivering what we were long warned about, particularly given our desultory vaccination program. Luckily, in the UK, it's all good. Indeed, freedom is back, it's Freedom Day, which sounds cloyingly American and perhaps to many Britons equally as foreign. So let's get an update on what's going on in a country in which the self-declared Freedom Day is accompanied by the Prime Minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Treasurer no less, and the Health Secretary are all in isolation as it takes place. What about the optics of that? So to discuss it all, it's welcome back to two Democracy Sausage favourites, Australians Abroad, Bevan Shields and Elizabeth Ames. Now, Elizabeth Ames is a former trade and diplomatic official who is now Chief Operating Officer at Atalanta. She's also Chair of the Menzies Australia Institute at King's College London and a Board Director of the Britain-Australia Society. And she's got a dog called Walter. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you very much. It's delightful to be back on the podcast. As you know, we just bought a house with a large garden for Walter. So I keep saying, you know, you spend a couple of thousand pounds on a dog and then you spend several hundred thousand pounds on a house for the dog.
Yeah, that's right. So Walter's going well. How old is Walter now?
He turns one in a month and we are having an engagement party, a housewarming and a Walter birthday party because we couldn't possibly have a celebration without including him.
No, indeed. Well, I'm glad to get an update on Walter because I have seen pictures of him on social media and he's an imposing figure, Churchillian almost. Let's move on to our other guest. Bevan Shields is the European correspondent for My Old Papers of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and of course is the source of much excellent reporting, indeed really the font of most of our knowledge about what's going on in Britain and the continent at the moment. Welcome back, Bevan.
Thanks, Mark.
I got to say, you know, for those listening, I appreciate both of you being there because, as I say, it is Freedom Day. It's in the afternoon that I'm talking to you, but it's first thing in the morning your time. So very much appreciate both of you getting up early to talk to us on this Freedom Day morning. Bevan, perhaps paint us a bit of a picture. As we speak, as I say, it is Freedom Day in London where you are. Yesterday, I saw at Silverstone the F1, there was something like 356,000 tickets sold to that event. It was a kind of an experimental event or a model event the UK government had approved. People could buy tickets, attend without masks. They had to be either double vaccinated or have a recent COVID test negative. But nonetheless, the event was, seemed extremely normal. There was even sunshine, which has perhaps not been so normal for the UK summer so far. Nonetheless, we see extraordinary figures of new infections and so forth. So perhaps give us a sense of what Freedom Day is. What are the restrictions that are being removed?
It's basically eliminating the last set of restrictions that have been in place since the second lockdown was introduced over Christmas for that really devastating second wave. So restaurants and things like that have already been open for a good couple of months now. This is basically wiping away caps on venues, caps on weddings, funerals, nightclubs can reopen, theatres can reopen. They're doing away with the 1 meter social distancing rule. And probably most controversially, and I think we'll probably talk about this, is not making masks mandatory anymore. So it's a funny vibe here, Mark, because summer has finally shown up here after a long absence. And I think there's a mix. I talked to a lot of people this weekend to try and sort of gauge the temperature of people. And I think there's a real mix between just sheer relief from a lot of people that perhaps this is close to over. That might be pushing it a bit far, but certainly relief that, you know, things are getting a bit back to normal. And also a lot of people, there's a lot of trepidation about this and a lot of people who feel this is happening too soon, too fast, and maybe a more cautious approach for a little longer would have been a good idea. Now, Boris Johnson's argument is, it's sort of now or never. If we don't release ourselves from these last restrictions now in summer, when you have the advantage of summer and school holidays and things like that, and you wait and do it over autumn or winter when the NHS is already under more pressure from what might end up being quite a bad flu season, you're going to run into trouble, possibly worse trouble, at the end of the year. So it's strange time. I don't think there are many people running around the street sort of waving flags and sort of saying, you know, freedom, freedom, sort of Braveheart style, but there are a lot of happy people. I was in Hyde Park on Saturday and it was just something so basic as seeing people laughing and smiling and happy and with their friends and family and, you know, throwing the frisbee. And you sort of forget, we've missed that for so long. When you see it, you sort of forget how nice it is. It's a real test tube situation here at the moment. Because I mean, this, don't you think this is exactly where other countries are basically going to have to go themselves at some point? That everyone is going to have to test the collision between, you know, mass vaccination coverage, ending restrictions, and a level of community transmission that can't be stopped. And so they're giving it a go here, and I think a lot of people are definitely watching.
Yeah, Elizabeth, I noticed that Bevan makes the point about mass vaccination levels, and that's certainly one of the keys to this. This is essentially the government's main justification for being able to do this. Something like 88% of adult Britons have had a first shot, and I think even more impressive, 2/3 or 67% have had both shots. This is overwhelmingly of AstraZeneca. But that's really the government's main justification, I suppose, for being able to do this, isn't it? They're really coming up with this argument of saying we've got significant levels of vaccination now, so we can do this. And what we're really about here is severing the link between the virus and severe cases and mortality.
Mark, I think that's entirely accurate. I would say I agree entirely with Bevan. We do need to learn to live with this disease. And, you know, Australia is getting a crash course at the moment, unfortunately, in what living with the disease looks like if you don't have an adequate vaccination rollout. But most countries would be looking to release restrictions at a point at which cases were not as high as they are here in the UK at the moment. So case numbers in the UK are back up where they were in sort of January, February, at the peak of the second wave, which, as we know, was so devastating for the British economy, the British people who were locked down again really severely, and also for the NHS that really struggled to manage that level of caseload and so pushed everyone else out of the hospitals. And we now have this huge waiting list of people who didn't get other routine treatment. But what is fascinating looking at the figures is how low the daily death numbers remain and how slowly the hospitalization rates have been rising. So at the start of this pandemic, you know, I think Bevan and I talked to you very early on in the very first wave and we didn't know what to expect. The idea was if we had a vaccine that would help stop people going to hospital and stop people dying, that would be the end of the pandemic. And that's effectively what we have. You know, people are not dying. People are not going to hospital despite the strength of this wave, despite the numbers. And so the question is then, and as Bevan says, the rest of the world is watching the UK to see what happens here. When you lift all restrictions, you have quite widespread community transmission. What does that look like? Does it become something more like a regular cold and flu and we stop getting daily case numbers and we stop thinking about it and we think just about numbers of people in hospital and number of deaths overall? Or are we about to see some sort of mass vaccination breakthrough event where the virus does jump through the vaccine protection, particularly one of the new variants, say the South African one, which looks like it is more virulent and isn't as well protected against by the existing vaccines? And at that point, is the UK the poster child for being a little bit too gung-ho on Freedom Day when we probably should have held off another couple of months until there were booster shots, until we knew more what the virus was evolving to be next?
Yeah, I think this is the real risk here. As you say, the UK could be a poster child for success and life after kind of COVID lockdown land, you know, the lockdown being the principal defence against the pandemic when you're dealing with it in the way that countries have had to deal with it. But now going beyond that with high levels of vaccination, and if it works, then I guess that's what the UK is going to be able to demonstrate. But it'd be wrong to say there's universal agreement on this, wouldn't it? I mean, there are plenty of people, epidemiologists and infectious diseases experts and people on the front lines in hospitals who are worried about being overwhelmed.
Even the chief medical officer, Chris Whitty, who, you know, stands up alongside Boris Johnson, is as much of a familiar figure in the UK as the Australian chief medical officers in the States, chief medical officers have been in Australia. Chris Whitty is now sort of saying, well, we should do it now because there is no other time, but also everyone should be very responsible and don't take it too far. And I will be wearing my mask and I wouldn't go to a nightclub. Although, to be frank, the idea of Chris Whitty, who is a sort of very nerdy looking guy in his 60s at a nightclub, is something pretty funny in and of itself. So there is a sense as well, and I'd be interested in Bevan's thoughts on this, that the government is now trying to push responsibility back onto people. You know, it is a conservative government. They do tend to like people to be making their own decisions and not to have government by diktat and government by, you know, sort of decision-making in parliament. And they want people to be taking on the risk themselves. And if you haven't been vaccinated, well, then that at a certain point that becomes your problem rather than the government and the rest of society's problem. But it feels like it's quite a dangerous time to be doing that given the case numbers.
Yeah, I think that's true. The other thing that's not discussed often is, you know, when people say you're being released from restrictions, that doesn't mean people have been complying with the restrictions. And I think mask wearing has been quite good, but compliance has been on the wane here for a very long time. So people are being released, but, you know, they're going into behavior that they're doing anyway. Mark, the interesting thing about the case numbers thing is, I'll just give you a really, just a simple couple of stats. Between the start of February and June 21, which is sort of the best figures we've got, about 92,000 people in England contracted the Delta variant. Now, only 7.8% of those cases were people who had been double vaccinated. And of those 92,000 cases, about 1,300 people ended up in hospital, and only 190 of those people had been double vaccinated. So I think, well, the big difference that a lot of my friends and family in Australia haven't got their head around here is that there's, yes, case numbers are bad. They might even get up to 100,000 a day, possibly even more. But it's sort of almost, I don't want to say it doesn't matter, but it case numbers aren't as significant as they used to be. They're not the benchmark of success or failure here at the moment. It's all these other things like hospitalization and the economy. And to be honest, you know, like kind of putting this sort of broken society back together after lockdowns. And it'll be the personal responsibility thing will be really interesting. And the big test of that will be masks, because the government is saying, okay, they're not mandatory, but we would like you to wear them. And the thing with masks is that masks are sort of more effective in stopping you from giving COVID to someone else rather than you getting it. So there is actually sort of, it's not even a personal responsibility factor there. It's more a kind of possibly a moral responsibility. If you're on a packed train, if I'm on the tube and it's packed, I'll be wearing a mask, not because I'm particularly worried about getting COVID again, because I do feel for all those people who will be on the tube and feel a bit anxious about this. But yeah, it's, and this is also Boris's, I think we now know from those very early days of the pandemic, we now know that Boris really struggled against the idea of a lockdown, that went against his libertarian instincts. And I think now we're seeing this is true Boris now, exactly as Elizabeth said. It's sort of about a focus on personal responsibility and choices rather than the intervention of the state.
A couple of questions there. One about masks. Do masks carry anything like the kind of political, you know, symbolism that they've been attributed in the US? And also, do you both acknowledge that, notwithstanding the observations you've made, that if it goes badly, then this has a very dire, it becomes a very dire warning for the world as well. Like at that point, countries like Australia or countries that are in that pre-release stage will take the view. Like say the UK hospital system does get overwhelmed, as some on the front line are worried that could happen. And it's certainly happening in other countries anyway, like Indonesia, where the hospital system is basically overwhelmed most of the time anyway. If that happens in the UK, then it's going to be a very kind of salutary lesson for everyone to manage the infection situation to zero, which seems to be the public policy aim in Australia all the time.
It is a real worry, that sense that if we don't get this right, and if the lesson that's taken from this is that you need to be in lockdown forever, that there are some countries, Australia included, that will relish that lesson. And you know, the public polling in Australia suggests that the Australian population are overwhelmingly in favour of keeping borders closed and hard lockdowns and eliminating the virus. So that is a big concern for me. The mask thing is interesting. I would say there's nowhere near the politicisation of masks here that there has been in the US. There have been a few reasonably right-wing MPs and commentators who've tried to turn it into a political gesture and a political statement. But in general, all of the MPs, you see them wearing them, whether or not they wear them as well as they could, is another question. But you see them wearing them. You know, we've seen the Queen in a face mask, which is, you know, the Queen exists, as she's often said, to be seen. And so I think sort of wearing a face mask and covering herself up was probably anathema to her as well. And we've seen images of her in a face mask out and about. So there is everyone's... Well, she's otherwise reasonably distinctive, but you know, they may have a body double in the basement at Windsor Castle. I haven't been to check lately.
They'd get another 10 years out of her if they operate like that.
Fidel Castro style. They don't have that significance, although I would say it's interesting seeing where the boundaries of that lie. Like Bevan, I will continue to wear a face mask in crowded spaces, and you know, the tube is a great example. I actually feel much more comfortable in the tube wearing a face mask just because the tube is such a disgusting hotbed of germs even when there's not a pandemic. But sitting on the tube, seeing who isn't wearing a face mask already is very interesting. And a lot of them are sort of younger people who are not wearing face masks, sometimes, you know, because it looks like they don't want to mess up their makeup, sometimes because it doesn't look cool, or they've got one around their wrist, which they'll put on if they get told off, but they won't wear it otherwise. And you do wonder, there are lots of people now who are claiming exemptions from wearing a face mask. And really, the only reason you mightn't be able to wear a face mask is if you've got really severe emphysema and are struggling to breathe. But to be frank, if you've got emphysema that badly, you probably shouldn't be leaving the house in the middle of a respiratory pandemic anyway. So I suspect there'll be more people self-claiming exemptions and not wanting to wear them as well in those kind of spaces, which, as Bevan says, is much more of a threat to others than to themselves.
I mean, on the question of if it doesn't, you know, what happens if it doesn't work? I mean, I'm not endorsing this at all, but I would question, if it can't work here, where can it work? If it can't work in a country where, I mean, because this spike will run out of puff at some point, probably in August, maybe early September. There's not going to be 100,000 cases a day forever. This will sort of fizz a little bit at some point. So if it can't work in a country where you have nearly nine out of 10 adults given one dose and two-thirds a second, and basically anyone who's over 50, more than about 95% of people in those age groups have had their full two doses, where can it work? And again, I just keep coming back to, it sounds calculating and cold and brutal, but when you do look at the death numbers, which I think people are increasingly focused on here, they're staying low. In fact, they're lower than more people have been dying here, despite this new wave, over the past couple of months from influenza and pneumonia, than they have COVID-19. So I don't know. I just feel like there's a big shift has happened here about people's understanding of, you know, what is an acceptable, terrible term, but what is an acceptable number of deaths and hospitalizations that society can live with if the trade-off is things stay open and we don't go back into lockdown.
Can we just take a quick break there and we'll come back in just a moment.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, I sort of rudely cut you off there, Elizabeth. I think you were about to make a comment about vaccination and perhaps school children.
Yes, I think that will be the next big discussion here. We now know that the majority of the virus spreading was when the schools reopened, and then children are seeding it back into family homes and back into, particularly in those sort of multi-generational households, which we know from devastating waves in Australia as well, at the most at risk. So there is a really live discussion here about whether or not we should be vaccinating 12 to 18-year-olds. My personal view is they've done it very successfully in Israel and the US, and it makes no sense to me that we haven't extended the vaccination program to children, particularly given we were right at the end of the summer term, so we could have gone through and done all the 12 to 18-year-olds in school for their first dose and given them a second dose when they came back from the summer holidays. For some reason, the Joint Committee on Vaccinations is sitting on that advice and isn't sort of stepping up, and it's not like it is in Australia. There isn't a lack of vaccines here. There's actually, and now you're only seeing 50,000 people or so a day getting their first dose. So we have a glut of things like the Pfizer vaccine, which is what would be used. So I think the next step will be, how do you get to that point of mass immunity? Because we're getting there with the adult population, both through vaccinations and through natural infection. But it's unconscionable to me that we are saying we'll have a summer where it will just rip through children and we don't know what the consequences of all of them having COVID are longer term when we have a vaccine that's been approved for use in that age group and we know is effective.
But isn't it unconscionable? I mean, this is such an interesting debate here. It's more charged than the mask debate. Isn't it unconscionable for advanced economies to be vaccinating children who, so far we know, are at the least risk of this thing, while there are countries around the world, developing countries, that are desperate for supply, desperately need supply for elderly people, people at risk, and that supply is going to children in advanced economies? I think that is completely wrong. And it's actually Sarah Gilbert, Dame Sarah Gilbert, who basically created the Oxford vaccine and was the, Mark, your listeners probably remember, was the scientist who had the standing ovation at Wimbledon, said yesterday, this shouldn't happen. This shouldn't happen. We should be distributing vaccines around the world before we think about vaccinating children. And, you know, the UK has domestic production capacity here. It should be sending as much of this stuff overseas as possible, if only, if not for the moral imperative, if only to stop potential other variants emerging elsewhere that become a problem down the track.
Do you think that this is broadly understood? That last point you make, Bevan, about other variants emerging, is it widely understood, do you think, by people that that is the process that viruses go through, that they have to replicate, there's the potential for mutations. Some of those mutations can accidentally, or however you want to describe it, result in the emergence of new variants that are more resistant potentially to vaccinations that exist. And therefore, that's why you need to make sure you don't have it running rampant through populations, not just for the illness and mortality that it creates, but because it allows the virus to live on and mutate.
I think there's a sense that probably, and I agree, Bevan, entirely with you, that we should be vaccinating people around the world, that, you know, the UK, having cut its aid budget, has a moral imperative to contribute to the kind of global good in whatever way it can. And this is a really obvious way in which it could be doing so, although I don't think that is the way, sadly, that the domestic debate here is going to go. And I think you will see children here vaccinated before we see the UK shipping large amounts of vaccine to other countries. I think there isn't enough understanding of that sort of epidemiological pressure. There was a great graph, I think it was in the Times over the weekend, which showed the way in which viruses mutate. And it sort of starts off, and it is a real parabola, you know, it goes up, straight up, and basically straight down. And we're at the point now at which the virus will mutate the fastest it can, because it's encountering so much natural resistance. And so we're actually at the point at which it's most likely that these dangerous variants emerge, as we saw in India. And then actually, as you get natural immunity, or you get immunity from vaccines, the virus finds fewer and fewer people it can infect. And so it does then come down. But we are globally at this point where we're sort of right up the top of this parabola in terms of those variants. I'm not sure that the population understand that. And I think there is a sense in the UK, which now has red list countries where you have to quarantine in a hotel like you do in Australia, as there is in Australia, that countries that don't have enough vaccine and where the virus is running rampant, well, we just won't visit those countries and we just won't let them into our country. And that is not the appropriate response to this. As Bevan says, the appropriate response is making sure that everyone has enough vaccine and that vaccine is distributed globally and stops those variants emerging. But in fact, what you will see, I think, is mass vaccination in rich countries and closing the border to countries that haven't been properly vaccinated.
I was asked on a radio interview I did just a couple of hours ago by a young journalist, and it was talking about the situation in Britain and making comparisons with Australia. What is the cultural difference between the two countries, where we have this mentality in Australia where we have to try and manage this to zero community infections? And you have a situation where, I think yesterday, for example, in the UK, we've been talking about significant numbers of infections, and I acknowledge the difference between infections and hospitalizations and deaths and so forth, but nonetheless, I think it was 49,000 new infections in the UK yesterday. We've got a lockdown in New South Wales with 98 announced today. That's the sort of number it's been at for the last 7 or 8 days, but you've effectively got, you know, the country's largest city locked down and significant areas of it, you know, almost cordoned off. I struggled in a way to answer this question, what was the difference? I mean, the best I could come up with was that I think the expectations are different because we find ourselves in completely different places. We have successfully got to zero community transmission of this virus, as we did at the end of the Victorian lockdown. And, you know, obviously it's got away from us again, but it's still in globally, in terms of global comparison, still at very low numbers. But there's an expectation here in Australia that we have to get back to zero. There isn't that expectation there. What's the explanation for that?
I mean, I think ultimately it comes down that Australia is a victim of its own success in a way, because that success is defined in Australia as zero cases, and that's the political imperative and narrative in Australia, and that just doesn't exist here. So I think people here basically know that we're stuck with it. This thing is going to be around forever in some form. And I still just am not convinced that there are a lot of people in Australia who recognize that just yet. And to be honest, Mark, I have to say the thing that is just getting at me the most in this whole thing, in the difference between the two countries, is this country has given itself a big wall of protection, as Boris Johnson would say, through the AstraZeneca vaccine. And the media has been responsible here. Politicians have been responsible here. The regulators, the various health bodies have been really responsible here about AstraZeneca. People believe in it. People have confidence in it. This is a vaccine that's helped businesses reopen and workers get back to work and families get back together, all that sort of stuff. And in Australia, it has just been comprehensively trashed by people in positions of leadership who should know better. And I, honestly, I actually think the attitude to vaccine now is actually, to me, the biggest sort of point of difference between the sort of culture in the UK and Australia at the moment, even more so than, you know, the different approaches in whether you suppress or, you know, try and knock this thing out. And honestly, I just look at what has happened in Australia to AstraZeneca, and I just shake my head, and I think in time, when the dust settles on all this, people will look back at that and think that and realize that that was a really shameful episode.
And Mark knows this is something I feel very strongly about, because I sometimes WhatsApp him with complaints about things that have been said on his podcast or things that are being said in the Australian media about AstraZeneca. You know, I've had two doses of AZ. It is proving unbelievably effective. And there's some interesting studies now coming out of Israel that seem to suggest that immunity from the mRNA vaccine wanes more quickly over time than that of the AZ vaccine. And so I think the best solution actually globally is probably some sort of mix and match, where if you have two AZ, you then get a Pfizer booster at some point, and vice versa. If you have two Pfizer, you have an AZ booster at some point. And so I agree entirely with Bevan. The Australian narrative around AstraZeneca has been completely appalling. You know, front page reporting every time someone dies of a blood clot, which is two people, as opposed to front page reporting every time someone dies of a blood clot caused by anything else. It's just insane watching it from the UK, to be honest. And I really hope that we're able to open and keep our rates low and keep our death rates low, because that is the best proof of the efficacy of the AZ vaccine, which, as we know, is able to be transported internationally much more easily. It's able to be given much more easily. It doesn't require the fiddly storage and cold chain supply chains that the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines require. And more to the point, it was developed with government support so that it could be sold at cost to the rest of the world, which is something that the other vaccines weren't. And I cannot understand how a company that has behaved so responsibly in this pandemic and is really sort of focused on the global good has been tarred so badly as a company that deliberately developed a vaccine that wasn't, you know, effective and that isn't, you know, is causing deaths worldwide. It's really appalling to me that that's happened to AstraZeneca, when they've been probably the most responsible global corporate player in the whole world during the vaccine.
Mark, you look less convinced. You look less convinced than Elizabeth and I on this one, I've got to say.
I know. I actually agree. I was about to say brilliantly said, actually. I thought, yes, that's a very persuasive argument. And I was thinking about who are the sort of culprits in this. And obviously there's been a fair bit of politics around it because a lot of the criticism of AstraZeneca has been really using it as a vehicle for attacking the failings of the government in terms of its vaccination program. So the government, AstraZeneca is the workhorse of the Australian vaccination program, at least to date. As of this week, we're told we're getting 1 million doses of Pfizer a week and it ramps up and so forth. But the government's been under a lot of pressure about that. And anything that has been able to show that AstraZeneca is not up to the mark and that it's been relied on unwisely by the government has been useful for people wanting to criticise the government. Mm.
I don't blame the public in this because, people have been fed this stuff, as I say, by people who should know better, politicians, former politicians, the media, and unfortunately some sort of epidemiologists and health experts who really should know better.
Yeah, chief medical officers.
Well, I mean, that said, it's not the only problem that Australia has or the only element of Australia's positioning which is dramatically different from other countries. And I think you've both acknowledged that there is a strong public sentiment of keeping the joint – support for keeping the joint shut, which for Australians abroad, such as yourselves with family back here – is extremely worrying, and that's also an element here. We've had governments effectively following that public lead, in a sense.
When I saw the federal budget announcement that the borders wouldn't reopen at the earliest until July next year, I was actually in an office with my team at Atalanta launching the global media report for something called the Independent Panel on Pandemic Preparedness and Response, which was this global panel chaired by Helen Clark, the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who was the former President of Liberia. And it was all about how we had responded to the pandemic and what we should do to prevent the next pandemic. And so I was in an office working on this amazing report with these fantastic recommendations to the world for how we should prevent another pandemic. And here's Australia saying that I won't be able to see my family and friends for another 12 months. And I burst into tears in the middle of the office because I was so upset. And I will almost certainly try and get back at some point this year to see my family and do the quarantine. And I have no objections to doing the quarantine, although I do think for double vaccinated people, home quarantine is a much more sensible solution and would help ease the pressure on the caps. But the idea that you can just cut off any citizen who is overseas and that my citizenship is somehow worthless because I've chosen to make a life overseas, and a life, I would add, that has spent a lot of time focused on promoting Australia abroad and extolling the virtues of the country that I love so much, to be told that my citizenship isn't worth as much as the citizenship of those people who are currently resident in Australia is really heartbreaking.
Devin?
Well, I can't top that. That was pretty good. I completely agree. I think when you look at – this is my observation anyway, and I'm conscious of, people go, oh, well, you're in the UK. But from the outside looking in, I think there actually has been a shift in the public mood in Australia on things like lockdowns and vaccinations. I think, people are probably starting to understand they need to get moving on vaccines a lot more and that the rollout is a shambles, and also – maybe starting to question whether, big citywide lockdowns for a few cases is the way to go until you get, everyone vaccinated. What I don't think is changing, if anything is going backwards, I think, is the border issue. I think it is hugely popular, and I really can't see that regime changing before the election, and including home quarantine or some level of different quarantine approach for double vaccinated people, because the truth is, even double vaccinated people, there will be cases from those people because the vaccines are not 100% effective in stopping transmission. So until the government is honest with people about that, I can't see that changing. Certainly, Mark, not this side of an election, whenever that might be.
Funnily enough, I think I'd I sort of broadly agree with what you're saying, but I think I'd say one of the lessons that's been learned here in recent weeks, and I referred to this a little bit in my introduction, is that lockdowns need to, if they're going to happen at all, they need to happen early. So in some ways, it's not just the borders that there's no great sign of opening up, the international border in particular, but it's also that even the single government that's probably been the most resistant to instituting restrictions on movement and a whole lot of other elements of pandemic control, that government being New South Wales, has had a lesson in what happens when you delay. And I think that even that is probably going to see more of a hair trigger in the future by that government, by other states as well. So, yes, it's a difficult one to read, but I don't think the situation in Australia looks like it's open to any dramatic UK-style change in the immediate future. As you say, probably not between now and the election, because that is the other big dynamic in this place. Let's just, while we can, though, go back to the situation in the UK, and particularly the political situation, because I think you made the point, Bevan, on Twitter, that it's interesting seeing these three ministers in self-isolation, you know, on the same day that that freedom is supposedly upon us. What was funny about it, I think, and this has just been so much of a feature of not just political shenanigans, but policy decisions as well, right through this COVID period, has been the extent to which policies and announcements can change, and can change quite quickly. So initially, Sajid Javid, the health minister or the health secretary, announces that he's tested positive for the virus. That means that people who've been in his close orbit also need to check their situation and go into, take measures. Two of those are the Prime Minister and the Treasurer, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak. Now, these two ministers basically, I think perhaps even three of them, certainly those two ministers initially took the view that they could be part of this new experimental arrangement for, I think, about 20 workplaces where they would continue working but be tested and contact traced. That lasted about 3 hours before they had to come out and say, look, all right, because there was, a public backlash of people saying, hang on, you can't have some rules for some and some rules, different rules for others.
There was a huge backlash in that 3 hours. If they actually had stuck to this and let it run, I think it could have almost been fatal for Boris. I really mean that, because it was, people are sick to death of this whole one rule for them and us thing, and it just completely shreds any compliance or confidence in any other, measures that the government's asking people to adhere to. I thought it was like, Tony Abbott's knighting Prince Philip moment, potentially. It's just one of those decisions that is just so toxic and dumb and stupid, and everyone talks about it at the pub or, the water cooler at the socially distanced office, and they backtracked quick smart. But, it does give you a bit of an insight, doesn't it? They've backtracked, but their initial response was to exempt themselves from the same rules that they're asking everyone else to comply with. And the background to that, Mark, is hundreds of thousands of people each week here are being pinged by the NHS app for being close contacts and told they have to self-isolate. It's actually becoming a real issue for the economy, actually. There's a lot of pressure on the government about whether the app is too sensitive or they need to be ease that off a bit. And then you have the Prime Minister and the Chancellor saying, of course that's not going to apply. To us, of course not. No, it was insane. But they pulled out of it quick smart.
That's the way the whole system's going to work, isn't it, Elizabeth? That this whole idea of releasing is going to be premised on the idea that if you are a contact of someone who's got the virus, that you undertake this self isolation 10 days, I think, rather than 14, which is interesting in itself. But it does have the potential for real danger to the economy, ongoing danger to the economy. If you've got significant outbreak, you're going to have a significant number of people, as Bevan said, hundreds of thousands potentially of people who may be having to self-isolate. That may mean businesses don't have enough staff to operate. You know, this potentially is not going to be easy.
I mean, we're already seeing the consequences of what has been called here, Mark, the ping-demic, because you get pinged by the app. So there are front page headlines. You have the Daily Mail, which is not a left-leaning newspaper, is going in hard against the government on this. You know, this morning's headline was, "When will this madness end?" So the idea that you have to isolate for 10 days, even if you've been double vaccinated, and the impact that that's having on the economy, you're already seeing staff shortages in the UK as a consequence, both of the pandemic and also as a consequence of Brexit and the inability of young Europeans to come over and work in, you know, restaurants and pubs and bars and shops. And the chief executive of John Lewis, which is a bit like Maya here, it's one of the, you know, it's the big department store that famously Carrie, now Johnson, the wife of the Prime Minister, hated their furniture so much that she had to go and spend, you know, £60,000 on a new flat decoration. Quite like John Lewis. If anyone ever wants to give me a voucher, I'd be very happy. But the chair of John Lewis came out and said, for every one staff member that tests positive, three more are having to isolate, and I'm going to have to close shops in the next month if we don't stop having this policy, if we don't stop people who've been double vaccinated having to isolate for 10 days. So the impact on the economy, particularly if we get up to that 100,000 daily cases, and if you think, you know, each case has 10 close contacts, which is a very small analysis of the way in which contact tracing might work, suddenly you've got a million people having to isolate every single day, 7 million people a week. That's a tenth of the UK population in isolation at any one time. That's just not going to be feasible.
And how are these people being identified? Is this a UK version of Australia's rather uncelebrated COVID-safe app, or is it as a result of contact tracing when people test positive?
It's primarily the app. So the UK, like Australia, or certainly like Victoria did, you know, went with the outsource model for contact tracing early on, and the test and trace system has been a debacle from start to finish. So instead we have this app, which is called NHS COVID-19, and you have to use it to scan in, like you do in Australia, scan in at a venue with a QR code, but it also is running in the background. So if you're close to someone who tests positive, it will tell you you need to isolate. And there are cases of people whose neighbours test positive being pinged through the wall because they spend too much time close to this person who's positive, even if obviously they don't actually have any physical crossover with them.
So that's working off Bluetooth, is it?
Yeah, it runs in the background on Bluetooth. And you're having a lot of people now saying, well, stuff it, I'm going to delete the app because it's Freedom Day. I don't need to check in anywhere. I don't need to prove my status. And in fact, I can't risk a ping because I'm finally back in the office, or I finally planned my wedding and I can't afford to be in self-isolation for that, you know, for the fourth time that I've tried to have a wedding. So I think that app is going to go down the drain pretty quickly if the pings continue and the isolation continues.
It's a very uncertain world that we live in, and one where changes happen hourly as much as they do weekly and daily, and so we'll just have to see where it goes from here. It's going to be fascinating and hopefully not disturbing to watch how the UK experiment goes, and maybe point the way forward for a world after the pandemic, a world that at least in some ways resembles the one that existed beforehand. Thanks both of you for getting up so early and being so chirpy and jolly at this stage of the day. It's a bit later for me, but I really appreciate that you've both done that.
Good to talk. Might be back to bed now. Thanks, guys.
Yes, I think I've leveled up my caffeine dosage over the course of the podcast. I'm probably much chirpier now than I was at the beginning.
Thanks again. That's Democracy Sausage for this week. Look forward to talking to you again next week. Until then, bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.